Hey, and welcome to the Parallax Podcast. I'm Liz Brown. In this week's podcast, I sat down to talk with Bruce Katz. Bruce is a distinguished fellow at the Lindy Institute for Urban Innovation and the director of the NOAC Metro Finance Lab at Drexel University. The lab was founded in 2018 to help cities develop innovative strategies to leverage public assets and fund infrastructure for public benefit, with a focus on supporting inclusive and equitable growth. He is also the co-author of The New Localism, How Cities Can Thrive in the Age of Populism, and was named the inaugural Centennial Scholar at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C. Bruce regularly advises government leaders on public reforms and private innovations that advance the well-being of cities. Bruce and I sat down to discuss his views on the future of Philadelphia. Here's our conversation.
You've operated at a federal policy level in various roles, while the late Jeremy Novak, your co-author for New Localism, was very rooted in the local scene in Philadelphia. How did those differing perspectives come together, and what were you able to learn from each other?
Well, to some extent, we were not that far apart, because when I was in the federal government, I worked for the Senate Banking Committee as a staff director that oversaw housing and transit, and then I went to be chief of staff at HUD. And at that point, I mostly engaged with practitioners all over the United States, because the theory of my bosses, senators, and ultimately Henry Cisneros, the secretary of HUD, is that the real expertise was local, and that what the national government needed to do was to almost reverse engineer policy, find the most innovative practices, and then enable and support the best practices. And Jeremy was one of them. So I met Jeremy going back, I don't know, 25 years, even longer, because he was like an icon in the Community Development Finance Institution movement. And that was a big program under Bill Clinton. So we weren't that far apart. I always, you know, took the theory that the locals knew best, and the federal government, instead of being at the top of the hierarchy, was really the platform, a foundation, an infrastructure to enable cities to do better.
And the city of Philadelphia has a lot of problems with things like poverty and climate change that now we've acknowledged that we can't solve on our own. Issues like these are complicated and interwoven. I guess in urban planning, we would call it a wicked problem. So how can something like New Localism be a mechanism to solve things like wicked problems?
Jeremy and I primarily thought that New Localism was a new kind of problem solving. So if you went back to the mid-20th century, when the federal government was at its apex and actually functioned to some extent, the theory of problem solving was that it would be top-down, driven by the federal government, and driven by experts, you know, specialized agencies with specialized expertise and experience. So if you had a transportation problem, you go to the Department of Transportation. You had a housing problem, you go to the Department of Housing and Urban Development. Our thesis was that in the 21st century, in a networked society, problems would be solved bottom-up, multi-sector, multi-layers, and interdisciplinary. If you have a traffic problem, it may not be the best idea to go talk to the Department of Transportation, because they'll probably just widen the road. So there might be a technology solution or a housing proximate to job solution to enable people to have, you know, more flexibility and greater access. So our thesis was that there's a structural change in the world in how we solve problems. And cities are really at the vanguard of that, because cities are not governments. The federal government is just a government, and state governments are just governments. And therefore, they can be hijacked by partisanship, and they often are. Cities are networks, public, private, civic, labor, environmental, community. And that enables different perspectives to be woven in and baked into solutions and then sustained over time.
I wanted to talk to you a little bit about how you think election cycles affect these types of things, the type of work that you do, and long-term approaches to this, like, creative problem solving.
Well, it's a great question, because I think one of the tensions in problem solving today is long-termism versus short-termism. Sometimes we think about that as a market problem, because corporations are just looking at their quarterly profit statements. And so their view of long-term is a quarter, and politicians think in terms of election cycles. But because the cities are networks, there are institutions, whether they're universities, whether they're philanthropies, intermediaries, business improvement districts, community development corporations, CDFIs like the Reinvestment Fund, they can take the long view, and they can basically buttress against this short-termism that otherwise exists in the political and the financial sectors. So cities are just more complex complex organisms. And the question is, which part of the city network is at the vanguard of the solution? It's not always the mayor. It's not always the city council. A lot of solutions are coming out of the private, civic, university sectors, and therefore they're more likely to take the long view.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting because here in West Philly, we have the University City Science Center, which is trying to be a hub for innovation.
Absolutely.
And they've been doing a ton of really great work. They're a really large nonprofit institution, but I think it's about 30 institutions partnered up in that organization. And I think a lot of people have no idea how much of an impact an organization like that actually has on the things that are happening in the city.
Yeah, I think when you say the word city, because we still think of government as the lead, even in the United States, where it hasn't been for a long time. I don't think people naturally think about networks, but the University City Science Center has been around for about 60 years or 50 years, and it's this consortium of institutions. You know, Philadelphia Industrial Development Corporations, they've been around for about 60 years. It's private-public, public-private. So, you know, cities can be organized in a way where they can maximize the impact of the non-public actors and then also take the long view.
The idea of creative placemaking as a whole is something I'm very interested in. And the recognition of how we can make and design urban environments and create curated spaces to expand our ideas. I'm curious to know, you know, if you could talk a little bit about the power of placemaking.
Well, placemaking plays a lot of different roles. And if you think about why we love cities, I grew up in Brooklyn, New York. So walking to the park or walking to the beach, I grew up right near the Atlantic Ocean, near Coney Island. Cities are complex places. Uses tend to be integrated, residential, commercial, infrastructure, transit, obviously. And public spaces tend, when they work, to be animated and vibrant, vital, and inclusive. They're democratic at their core. We sort of lost that for a while in the middle of the 20th century when the suburbs took hold and the notion that we should be segregating uses and literally segregating people became the way in which the U.S. developed itself. The best thing about the last 25 years from a city perspective is we've gone back to the future in a lot of ways, and armed with technology, and we've recognized that complexity matters a lot to how we build our cities. And that means we've got to have the right kind of land use and zoning and financing and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's not easy to do at times because the laws and the financial instruments tend to support more segregated uses. But when a place is complex and animated, that's when cities function. And that's when more innovation actually occurs, the exchange of ideas. I think the biggest change in cities is demographic preferences have changed. And the preferences, therefore, of companies and where they locate, particularly companies in the innovative space, they tend to reward places where you can live, work, and play. And you have collisions and connections between people. That's how innovation occurs. This notion that innovation is occurring in a garage in Silicon Valley is absolute nonsense. I mean, it's more of a collaborative, integrated kind of act. So I think the revival of cities has less to do with policy and more to do with deep structural changes in the market and preferences of people. And therefore, I think it can outlast any administration, even one as horrific as the one we have right now in Washington.
I'm curious to know what you think about the idea of extending the term innovation beyond sectors like tech. That's something that I'm always trying to explain to people. I've worked in tech for the past 10 years, and I've been moving towards using the word innovation so that I can attach myself to different sectors a little bit more. But how do we continue to extend the term innovation?
I think innovation is a very narrow term. A very close friend of mine, Ross Baird, wrote a book called The Innovation Blind Spot. Great,
really good book.
Great book. And it basically posits that the definition of innovation is so fundamentally narrow. And therefore, the financing and venture capital for innovation tends to be locked up in Silicon Valley and Boston and New York because we're really looking for like the next app, you know? when, frankly, some of the most innovative work that goes on in cities may not be technologically driven or technologically based. Solving the issue of schools and education, connecting people to the labor market. I mean, so many of these fundamental issues dealing with the opioid crisis, they're innovative. Solutions are fundamentally innovative, and yet we've put them in this box, separated tech from the rest of the economy. And therefore, I think the capital that's needed to really fuel solutions in our cities, you know, overfinances one part of the equation and underfinances the rest. So I think we have to redefine innovation fundamentally. And a lot of my work with Ross is about community wealth. And at the core of it is redefining what innovation means.
If cities are seen to be the world's problem solvers, then we need to rethink how they function. New forms of leadership, financial instruments, intermediaries, and institutions need to be re-envisioned. I think we can agree on that. And cities have to find new ways to collaborate across different sectors and communities. But how do we actually do that? How do we actually make sure that these things are happening? What strategies can we put in place?
So I think in an urban world, what matters, and this is what Jeremy wrote and I wrote about, are norms and models. Because the way innovation, the urban innovation occurs writ large, is one city innovates, like Copenhagen, on climate change. Copenhagen is on target to reach zero carbon emissions by 2025. The rest of the world talks about 80% reduction in carbon emissions by 2050. They're on target to go to zero by 2025. So one city innovates, and it's usually, with an issue like climate change, pretty damn complex. They're working on energy production, they're working on energy efficiency, they're working on transportation, behavior change of people, recycling, and so forth. And then two or three or five other cities codify and then follow. And if you're fortunate and you pay attention to what are those core elements, soon it just becomes the way everyone operates. You get routine financial instruments and institutions with capacity and capital to actually get stuff done. And so there's a different kind of circuitry. We're not waiting for Washington. You know, we're not waiting for Godot and manna to fall from heaven and the smartest rules by the smartest people. I mean, that was really a mid-20th century notion, and that didn't really pan out very well, particularly for cities. We chopped up cities in every particular way possible. So I think this is a different kind of horizontal adoption and adaptation of solutions that is going on in the world today. It requires a lot more resourcing than governments, philanthropies, corporations have given to it, frankly. And so unless we do that, I think Copenhagen will be this shiny example, but not a lot of places will ultimately follow.
That's very unfortunate, actually. I hope people do follow.
We have to perfect a process of problem solving. As you said before in the opening question, we have to rethink our institutions because most of our institutions are mid-20th century. They're either public or private. They don't have the hybrid, and they don't really draw the best out of each kind of sector or each kind of way of thinking about things. So a lot of my work these days at Drexel focuses on new kinds of hybrid institutions, public-private institutions coming out of Northern Europe that leverage public assets, the sale of land and buildings, they use revenues from that to build, for example, the modern subway system in Copenhagen, as opposed to taxing citizens. And the second, you know, what the U.S. contribution is, more private civic kind of institutions like the Center City Development Corporation in Cincinnati or the Cortex Innovation District in St. Louis. So the 21st century should be a period of a burst of new kinds of institutions and intermediaries that enable cities to get the job done. It's been slow. I still think we've got a lot of legacy institutions and a lot of legacy thinking.
Today, there are definitely people out here trying to showcase Philadelphia as a place for innovation. But how do we really make sure that we're creating an innovation ecosystem that is sustainable and continues to go on?
I do think Philadelphia is quite interesting in the sense that you might have the deepest bench of practitioners in the United States. When I look at, as we talked about before, the Philly Industrial Development Corporation or the Center City Bid, the University City Bid, the University City Science Center, Shift Capital, the Reinvestment Fund, You've got some of the best institutions in the country and some of the best people cracking at problems. The reputation of Philly is as a place that doesn't quite collaborate to compete. you know, everyone's in their sort of like foxhole economy. It takes too much effort to get beyond your own institution. So I think you start with this incredible base of talent at the city level and in communities. And the question is, how do you accelerate that cycle of working together across disciplines, across sectors, around what are really hard challenges? And I see that happening in North Kensington, actually, which I think is going to become a model for many of these highly distressed neighborhoods in terms of both economic rejuvenation, but also dealing with some of the social issues. But it's going to take a different kind of non-siloed approach to make this happen.
In what ways do you think that we can continue to move away from the siloed approach? This is my everyday challenge.
I think government, and frankly, a lot of financial institutions are organized in silos, right? I mean, because it's the old model of deifying specialization and expertise. And so bureaucracies are siloed, and they're hard to basically move across. When I was at the chief of staff at HUD, the Department of Transportation was literally across the street in Washington, D.C. You think, you know, anyone who lives in the real world realizes, hey, housing, transportation, they're sort of connected. We couldn't really figure out until the Obama administration ways to actualize some serious collaboration. So I think what you need are, frankly, intermediaries that basically go between the government or between financial institutions and the street, so to speak. Because if we want integrated places and, you know, vibrant and vital placemaking, it's not going to happen through silo government. It's going to happen through new kinds of intermediaries that can braid and blend programs and capital to make stuff happen. Government and the finance sector, I think, are hopelessly compartmentalized.
It's really something we had talked about with another guest previously was language and the use of different language for the same thing across different industries. Some of us really do the same types of work, but we just don't even realize it because we're calling it something else.
And to some extent, I do a lot of work around project finance, for example, where you have to blend equity investment and bank debt and public incentives and concessionary capital. And finance in the United States has been run by the merchants of complexity. We've taken what is a math problem and we've made it unbelievably difficult when actually it's not that difficult. So demystifying, you know, finance and finding a new way of talking about it so it can be more democratic and inclusive is fundamental, actually. Because when an investor is speaking to a community, they're really not talking the same language, but they should be.
You refer to Pittsburgh as an example of the principle of new localism. Can you tell me more about that? Why Pittsburgh? What is Pittsburgh doing that's making you say that?
I think Pittsburgh is a model of growth, of really rethinking what are your assets. Pittsburgh was a place, like a lot of places, that was hit by a brutal crisis, economic crisis, but it almost happened overnight with the collapse of the steel industry in the United States. I mean, they lost like tens of thousands of jobs. So they had to basically not look back, but look forward and understand with precision, what did Carnegie Mellon have and what did Pitt have that could be the foundation for next generation technologies? And when they started doing this stuff in the 1980s, robotics and autonomous vehicles and artificial intelligence and machine learning and data analytics, genomics, we didn't even know what any of that stuff was. We didn't even have a name for any of this stuff. But they invested in the future. The state, the Commonwealth was functional then. It's not particularly functional now. Philanthropy had patient capital. Corporations invested, and the universities themselves invested. And so I think what has happened over time is if you look at the way the world is changing, and there's maybe 12 or 15 next generation technologies which are blowing through the world, Pittsburgh's in like five of them. I mean, they're like a first mover in this stuff because they think like a system and they act like an entrepreneur. At the city level, they do that. And so I think the story in Pittsburgh is a different sectors bet on the future and invested at scale in a sustained way. They didn't change their focus. You know, it wasn't the idea of the moment. They just stuck to it. And too much of what goes on in cities is a philanthropy comes in and 3 years later, they change the dial. Pittsburgh stuck to it. And I think that's a great lesson.
I'm curious to know what you think a good roadmap for Philadelphia would look like in terms of some of the changes that you see in Pittsburgh. How can Philadelphia do the same? Or are we already doing it?
Well, you're doing it to some extent. You have great institutions here. I mean, you know, a lot of why cities succeed starts with their advanced industries and their advanced institutions. I mean, we don't normally talk about this in the U.S., but it starts with institutions or companies that have high levels of research and development and are really stock full with skilled workers, science, technology, engineering, math, the arts. I'm not talking about four-year degrees. A lot of these are credentialed people. They may have gone through community college, through a special program. So you've got to start with what you're good at and then be the best 21st century version of it. And you have to invest in it with patient money, with long-term money. It goes back to your point about long-termism. The challenge in Philadelphia compared to Pittsburgh, I mean, Pittsburgh's, you know, 300,000 people, Philly in the city. Philly's 1.4 million in the city. The philanthropies in Pittsburgh are like supersized. Philanthropy in Philadelphia is pretty small for a city this size. And so I think one of the biggest issues in Philadelphia is, A, understand you've got some amazing assets. Penn and Drexel and Temple and Thomas Jeff and all this stuff. But your philanthropic sector is unbelievably weak, and it needs to be grown because without it, you don't have enough of that patient long-term capital to invest.
I've been working with venture capital for the past 2 years, and every founder that I've met has had to go outside of the city to raise funds to build whatever they're trying to build. It's really interesting because we're in a good location. We have access to New York. We have access to DC. I mean, it's not very far from a lot of really great places, but for some reason, we're lacking on that funding side.
And capital's not really the problem in some respects, because if you look at your endowments, pensions, high net worth individuals and families, there's an enormous amount of wealth in this place. But it tends to be exported out to Silicon Valley, Boston, and New York. I mean, the biggest export of most American communities is wealth, because it may have been generated locally, but then it's invested through hedge funds or private equity firms or venture capital firms somewhere else. So I really think that we need to focus on investing local wealth locally, that has to be a structural shift in the U.S. of how capital flows. If we could figure that out, I think we would solve some of these market gaps that you're describing.
So another big issue is just getting people to understand some of these problems and then implement the changes that we need to implement and make impact. How do we move from understanding things to actually implementing something that's impactful?
I work a lot with a group called Accelerator for America that was started by Eric Garcetti, the mayor of Los Angeles, and he described Accelerator for America as a think and do tank. So yes, we're diagnosing problems or codifying solutions, but then we're actually testing them and we're experimenting them and we're getting stuff done. And it's only through the process of getting stuff done that you can figure out, well, okay, well, that works, but this thing doesn't work, or if we moved it in this particular direction, it could have bigger impact from an inclusive perspective or sustainable perspective. He's also the head of C40, which are the climate mayors. So he's taking a very broad perspective on what are urban challenges and what's the solution set and where are they being invented. They might not be invented in the U.S., frankly. We're more of an adopter or an adapter than the first mover. So I think we're a practical people. It's one of the great things about the United States. Practitioners really dominate, but I think we've left a lot of our solutions to the think tanks or the universities, and we need to engage reflective practitioners in the design, financing, and delivery of solutions. They are the true experts, and we really need, and that's what we're trying to do with the NOAC, you know, finance lab, is really let practitioners take the lead and follow their lead.
In my graduate program, I had one person that was currently a practitioner that was teaching us. And I was also teaching at Drexel recently in the design school, and a lot of my students said that they had never had a professor that was currently practicing their work. I definitely think that there need to be more opportunities for people to also learn from people that are practicing on a daily basis and not just out here with a bunch of ideas and no action.
Absolutely. and you know, and cities are great laboratories.
Yeah, amazing laboratories. I mean,
so you don't have to go that far, literally, from Drexel or Penn or Temple or the other great universities to where the action is. Just walk a couple blocks, you'll find it.
There's also things like opportunity zones, and I really would like to know how you feel opportunity zones function to build local business ecosystems and provide a stimulus for innovation.
Well, opportunity zones are really just a tool, because it's a federal tax incentive that enables people with capital gains or corporations with capital gains to defer, reduce, or even eliminate capital gains taxes. So all it is a tool. And if we want to finance what we want, workforce housing, commercial real estate, nodes of commercial strength in our low-income neighborhoods, businesses that are owned by people of color, local infrastructure, high-speed internet, and so forth, market equity is not going to do it by itself. It's got to be coupled and complemented and blended with debt and public incentives and concessionary capital. So I think what's happening in the world is we're moving from a very narrow, silo-driven view of community development. Community development for decades was, let's just build more low-income rental housing in low-income neighborhoods. That's all it was. And it was mostly just debt and subsidy. And now we've introduced this new kind of financial instrument or tool, equity, looking for returns, and it's mixing it up. And I think, you know, Ross Baird and I have a paper coming out literally in 2 weeks called From Community Development to Community Wealth, because at the end of the day, we just don't want to, you know, measure our success by how much low-income rental housing did we build, but did we help people become homeowners or business owners or gain the skills that they need to participate in today's economy and continue to participate and thrive. So we're trying to redefine what we're trying to do in these communities. And Opportunity Zones has ironically been a catalyst for this because of the work of, you know, a broad different group of stakeholders, starting with mayors like Garcetti. Mayor Pete was very involved from the very beginning. Mayor Holt in Oklahoma City, Mayor Fisher in Louisville. So we'll see. We'll see if people sort of rise to the occasion and say, let's create a 21st century system that can have a 5X, 10X effect on the size and scale of businesses owned by people of color. I'm going to Oakland tomorrow to meet with a group of Black investors, developers, entrepreneurs, churches, professionals, so that we can create these new ecosystems that can, again, accelerate what we want done.
There are a lot of barriers to entry into innovation.
Totally.
And things like investment and things like, just to get to that point takes a lot. What are some of the biggest barriers that you've seen in working with different communities?
To tell you the truth, I think the biggest barrier goes back to some of the other things we were talking about. As you think about the quote-unquote innovation ecosystem narrowly defined, you've got advanced research, you've got mature companies, you've got startup and scale-ups, you've got incubators, accelerators, you have angel and seed money. You've got this thick and textured ecosystem. Then you go to the other side and say, hey, how do we get, you know, a person of color to be a real estate developer or to run a business that's serving their local community? There's like no ecosystem. There's really no way to identify, to mentor, to nurture, to help them access capital. So on one side, we've got this unbelievably textured system. And on the other side, it's like, well, we have a couple rules. The banks are really not lending or providing working capital.
They're still redlining.
No, absolutely. And the real capital coming into many of these neighborhoods is parasitic capital. It's Family Dollar or the dollar stores or check cashers or payday lenders. You know, you get what you build, what kind of ecosystem you build. So I think we need to focus on structure, not just on transactions, and a new kind of system that can be built. And maybe Philadelphia is the place to start it. I mean, there are more than enough people who want to do the right thing and actually understand how to get stuff done here. So this could be, there could be a Philly model developed.
One of the biggest challenges that I've had so far is trying to get people to take a step away from focusing on quantitative information and focus a little bit more on qualitative, because I think that many of the reasons why people aren't comfortable with taking the risk to try something new is that they don't feel that they're in a safe space. They don't feel that they can trust the people who are trying to bring that resource into their community. And I had the same thing happen to me when I was working in West Philadelphia. I was working from 40th Street down to 60th Street, running all of these block parties. And the focus was to teach people about green roofs and how to be green and how to save money and how to understand that there are all these resources available to them. But the immediate thought that people had was, why do you care? Are you trying to raise my property value? Are you trying to come into my house and assess it so that you can continue to gentrify my neighborhood and push me out? I think it's one of the saddest things that even though there are so many people out here really trying to make a difference, there's not enough focus on qualitative and understanding the wicked problems and how that affects someone's entire psyche when it comes to making those decisions to try something new or to trust somebody with these resources.
Yeah, I think that's a very good assessment. I think there's been an erosion of trust over decades, and it's completely understandable. You go back to urban renewal, you go back—
Which was horrible.
It just blew apart whole neighborhoods. You go back to freeway expansion in the U.S., which just divided and fragmented cities and contributed to hypersegregation and redlining, et cetera, et cetera. You can understand why there's a lack of trust. I mean, there are communities that have had dozens of plans created for them and nothing has happened. So I think, you know, we could look to the technocratic and let's get the perfect financial product, but probably the most important thing is to restore trust. And that only happens through a kind of inclusionary process where voices that have been disregarded can actually come to the table and be respected.
You describe metro finances as a new field and leveraging the market and financial power of cities to drive investments in innovation and infrastructure and inclusivity. How does Novak Metro Finance Lab advance these interests?
You know, Jeremy and I were really intrigued by this notion that we have muni finance, right, which is the way the cities go to the capital markets to build infrastructure. But the way in which a lot of stuff gets financed in cities today is this blend of public, private, and civic capital and debt subsidy and equity. And that's what we labeled metro finance, frankly, because it was just a nice alliteration between muni and metro. So the most important thing we do is we're trying to codify examples of either institutions that are able to regenerate and revitalize at scale in inclusive ways through this blending of public, private, and civic capital, or actually new financial instruments and products that can do the same. And so we're on the hunt, so to speak, to find those proven institutions and proven instruments, and then break them down and make them transparent and communicate their essence in ways that, you know, in the end of the day, can be adopted and adapted and replicated by multiple cities or multiple actors. So that's the theory of change that basically we're following with New Localism. And, you know, Philly's just an incredible laboratory. The best initiative around taking quote-unquote disadvantaged residents, we don't even really have the right words for most of this stuff, and giving them the skills to participate in the anchor institutions, giving them that entry in the labor market, is West Philadelphia Skills Initiative. So we're doing a city case on that, breaking it down so that dozens of cities can basically, maybe not replicate exactly the model that's been used here, but adapt it to their own conditions and circumstances. You know, I'm a big believer that, you know, you have to write it down. You got to codify it. You just can't talk about it. You can't go to endless forums and look at a PowerPoint deck. You've got to break it down so that actually it can be routinized and standardized. That's how change happens in a system like ours. It's not like the tablets being handed down from the mountain. So I really do hope that we have a different president in 2021, but I think there will be limits to his or her power, frankly. The power is local today.
Yeah, the power is in the people.
The power is in the people.
And it always has been.
Absolutely.
I definitely think that people forget that, and more people need to get involved than there are. I find it very interesting how one day there can be a protest and then the next day people just disappear. There's just nothing. People just stop. But I guess that is the nature of the world that we live in. It's not easy to make yourself available to always fight the good fight.
Right.
But there are people out here that are really trying to make a difference. And I do feel like Philadelphia is the place for me personally, because I see the way that Philadelphians are out here handling problem solving. There are a lot of really interesting people in our city doing really interesting work across different industries and trying to really get out of the whole siloed system.
I mean, in many respects, Philadelphia is at the vanguard of New Localism. When you look at these different institutions, intermediaries, seasoned professionals, community activists, some of the best in the United States, some of the best in the world. The question, does it add up? Does 2 + 2 = 5, really? That's the new math that you want cities to perfect, but it requires a more intentional kind of collaboration, organic collaboration across these divides that we have in our cities, whether it's race, ethnicity, class, academic credentials, et cetera. We got to break this down. Cities are the world today. The nation state has been diminished. The city state's been elevated. We have to figure this out.
And once again, I'll say it, we have more in common than not.
Totally.
And I think that if people just get in the same room together and talk about what it's like to be a human being living in whatever city you're in and just going through your day-to-day life, you'll realize how much more we really do have in common with one another than it seems.
I completely agree with that.
Thank you so much for sitting and talking with me today.
It's been a blast.
I feel my mind is going to all different places. I really appreciate this, and I look forward to seeing what else you do.
Let's take to the streets.
Yeah, let's take it to the streets. We've got this.
Thanks so much for listening, and thank you to Bruce Katz for stopping by the studio. Be sure to subscribe in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, and Google Play. And when you do, don't forget to leave a rating and review. We'll rely on your feedback to make this project the best it can be. Any further thoughts on the conversation? Send a tweet or message to us at Parallax Collab on Twitter. A special thanks to Christopher Heckler for editing today's episode, Kilimanjaro for our music, our producers Helene Forian, Lee Nentwig, and Nicole Koltik. This project is made possible by support from the Excite Center, the Design Futures Lab, and a recording space at the Dornsife Center for Community Partnerships at Drexel University. Thanks so much for listening.